Today, we're diving into one of the most misunderstood and underappreciated periods of church history, a period that historians refer to either as the Age of Confessionalism or Protestant Scholasticism. Now, depending on who you ask, it's either the golden age of Protestant theology or the moment the Protestants got a little too comfortable sitting behind their desks. Probably both, honestly. So let's set the scene. The year is roughly 1560. Martin Luther's been dead for a decade. Calvin's wrapping up his ministry in Geneva. The Reformation has cracked the Western Church wide open, and now the great question facing Protestants isn't whether to reform, it's exactly what do we believe? And can we please write it down so that everyone stops arguing? And voila, the age of confessionalism is born. Now, before we go further, let's talk about that word scholasticism, because it sounds intimidating and a little dusty. Like something that you'd find in the back of a seminary library next to a forgotten cup of cold coffee. Many episodes ago, when we looked at the scholasticism of the Roman Catholic Church in the 12th through 14th centuries, we saw that scholasticism really was just a method. It was a rigorous, highly structured approach to doing theology. It used careful, logical distinctions, systematic categories, and philosophical tools that had been borrowed mostly from Aristotle to organize and then defend Christian doctrine. It asked questions like, what exactly do we mean by this word? Or how does this doctrine relate to that doctrine? How do we answer the strongest possible objections to our faith? The medieval Catholic Church did that brilliantly, Thomas Aquinas being the towering example, building enormous theological systems called summae that tried to, well, organize everything from the nature of God to the ethics of money lending. And they were genuinely impressive works. Whatever else you think of Thomas Aquinas, that man could think. Now, here's where it gets interesting. When the reformers first broke with Rome, many of them were suspicious of all of that Aristotle-soaked philosophical machinery. Luther famously called Aristotle that rascal, and other things we can't repeat on a G-rated program. The early Reformation had an almost allergic reaction to medieval scholasticism. They wanted to get back to the Bible, not back to the lecture hall. But here's the irony. Within a generation, Protestant theologians were doing scholasticism all over again, and they were doing it enthusiastically. So, how was Protestant scholasticism different from Rome's version from a few centuries before? Well, the key distinction was the Catholic scholasticism ultimately placed the authority to interpret scripture within the church and its tradition. So the Pope, you know, councils, the teaching magisterium. The scholastic method served that ecclesiastical authority. When Aquinas reasoned his way through a theological problem, his conclusions were expected to harmonize with what the church had already declared. Protestant scholasticism flipped that script entirely. For Protestant scholastics, scripture alone was the supreme authority, the norma normans, that is the norm that norms all other norms, as they would like to say in Latin, because everything sounds more authoritative in Latin. The creeds, the confessions, church councils were useful, even binding for a congregation, but they were always subordinate to what Scripture said. The scholastic method was now a servant of biblical exegesis, not ecclesiastical tradition. That's a fundamental difference, even when the logical machinery looks surprisingly similar from the outside. Now, this era is called the Age of Confessionalism for good reason. It produced an extraordinary flood of written confessions, catechisms, doctrinal standards that Protestants are still using today. On the Lutheran side, Philip Melanchthon, you remember he was Luther's brilliant, slightly anxious colleague, had already given Lutheranism the Augsburg Confession in 1530. But after Luther died, Lutheranism started fracturing into factions squabbling over what Luther really meant. To settle things down, a group of Lutheran theologians produced the Formula of Concord in 1577, which was eventually gathered into the Book of Concord in 1580. The key figure in this was Martin Chemnitz, sometimes called the Second Martin. In fact, a popular saying was, if Martin, meaning Chemnitz, had not come along, Luther's work would have collapsed. That's high praise. Now, Chemnitz was also the author of a devastating four-work critique of Catholic Counter-Reformation's Council of Trent. Rome really never fully answered. On the Reformation side, you get a remarkable burst of confessional writing at right about this time, from which the period gets its name. The Heidelberg Catechism of 1563, the Belgic Confession of 1561, the Second Helvetic Confession of 1566, and eventually the Westminster Confession of Faith that comes in 1646, which is arguably the most carefully crafted Protestant doctrinal statement ever produced. That was hammered out by 121 ministers, theologians, and parliamentarians who met at Westminster Abbey for over 5 years. Now think about that. They spent 5 years on the Westminster Confession. Those guys took their theology seriously and their meetings and probably the coffee they drank. Well, with confessions in hand, the next task was systematizing and defending Protestant doctrine at a university level. And here you meet some of the great, if somewhat overlooked, minds of that era. Theodore Beza was John Calvin's successor in Geneva. Beza is often credited with hardening Calvinist theology into a tighter, more rigid, logical system. Now, critics say that Beza took Calvin's warm pastoral theology and turned it into a precise theological machine. The supporters say that he clarified and defended it brilliantly. In Germany, Johann Gerhard became the greatest Lutheran theologian of that era. His massive 9 volumes of systematic theology was so comprehensive and carefully argued that it dominated Lutheran theological education for over a century. Gerhard was also deeply devotional, writing his famous Sacred Meditations while still a young man. He was not just a brilliant academic, he was a man of genuine faith and prayer. And then there's Francis Turretin of Geneva, whose Institutes of Alentic Theology became so much the standard that it was used as the primary theology textbook at Princeton University into the 19th century. In England, William Perkins deserves, I think, more attention than he typically gets. A Cambridge professor and prolific author, Perkins was one of the founding figures of English Puritanism and a master of making scholastic Reformed theology accessible to ordinary people. He was so popular, check this out, his collected works outsold every other English author of his era, including Shakespeare. So why did this happen? Why did the children of the Reformation reach for their Aristotle? Well, part of it was simply necessity. Once you no longer are a reform movement, and you're now running universities and training pastors and governing churches, you need precise definitions. Vague inspiration is great for starting a revolution. It's less helpful when you're trying to explain to a congregation exactly what happens at the Lord's Supper and why that matters. Now, part of it was polemic. Protestants were in constant debate, not just with Rome, but with each other, as we've seen in our review of the Reformation here on the Enduring Word YouTube channel. Lutherans and Reformed theologians argued fiercely over the Lord's Supper, over Christology, predestination. You need careful, logical distinctions to fight those battles well. And part of it, honestly, was just the way university trained European intellectuals thought. Aristotelian logic was the grammar of educated discourse. To be taken seriously in the academy, you had to speak the language. Still the case, isn't it? The result was a generation of deeply learned, sometimes formidably technical, but often genuinely devout theologians who built the doctrinal infrastructure that would sustain Protestant churches for centuries. The age of confessionalism sometimes gets a bad reputation, criticized for being dry, defensive, overly academic. And sure, reading Francis Turretin at midnight isn't for everyone, but this era gave Protestant Christianity its confessional backbone, its theological precision, and its ability to answer hard questions under pressure. These men knew that doctrine mattered, that truth was worth defining carefully, defending vigorously, and passing on faithfully to the next generation. And speaking of the next generation, that's exactly where our story takes a dramatic turn. Because just as Protestant scholasticism reached its confident, systematic peak, a challenge was brewing. A serious theological controversy that would shake the Reformed world to its foundations. And we're going to get to that next time. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next episode.